FM presents a talk organized by the International Relations Department entitled The World Unravels, Reflections on the First World War. This talk is delivered by Professor Joseph Pirotta.
Welcome. In literature, there's a term known as pathetic fallacy, where nature is attributed human emotion. And we can safely say today that it is a miserable day. Humid, misty, windy, cloudy, drizzly. It seems that nature has chosen to provide us with the appropriate backdrop and the props for the theme of today's talk. Our department is marking the beginning of the First World War, a war which started in July 1914 and was supposed to last until Christmas. Of course it didn't. It dragged until 1918, a period during which Malta first earned its title as the nurse of the Mediterranean. During this war, it was estimated that around 16 million people lost their lives, 7 million of which were civilians. Even if then, civilian mortality was much less than it is in modern conflicts. The theme we will be exploring today is The World Unravels, Reflections on the First World War. Let us not let the miserable context and poignant theme betray the fact that it is a very happy day for me. It is our very first public lecture organized by the department ever since I assumed the headship in the beginning of this month. And it is a great pleasure for me to introduce you to Professor Joseph Pirotta, who is the founder of our department. Professor Pirotta retired at the end of September 2018 after a teaching career that spanned over 50 years, the last 29 of which he spent at the University of Malta. He holds a PhD in politics from the University of Reading. He has published various books, papers, and articles dealing with aspects of modern and contemporary Maltese political and constitutional development. He has also contributed to history programs for both radio and television, and in fact, I wish to inform you that this lecture is being recorded to be broadcast on Campus FM. So, Professor Pirotta.
Thank you for that introduction. After hearing that introduction, I'm looking forward to meeting Professor Pirotta if he comes along this morning. But seriously, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I was asked by the department, which I thank, to present the first public lecture. It is an honor for me to do so. Dr. Samut spoke about pathetic fallacy and the weather, and I hope it doesn't reflect on the kind of lecture I'm going to give. The World Unravels, Reflections on the First World War. Now, what I mean to do during the time we have together is not to try and go into the intricacies of the war or its military side. Enough has been said, written about that. Rather, what I'm going to try to do is to ask two basic questions. Why did the war break out? And how did the war's ending affect future international relations? This, broadly speaking, will be what I will attempt to tackle. We're going into an era which is completely different from anything we know today. If we look at old photographs of the period, these sepia-toned photographs, we are presented with a world which appears extremely calm. One of the reasons was photography wasn't in its beginnings and people couldn't move about for the photo. So everything is static, everything seems so still. But in reality, things were not like that. At the beginning of the 20th century, Europe was still dominated by emperors, kings, queens, and an influential nobility. Now, one of the common factors of these monarchs was their ability to look on the lighter side, and by lighter I mean less profound side of things. They were very good at posturing. They were extremely good at romantic militarism. They liked to appear in public wearing military uniforms with all the regalia and so on. But in reality, were they capable of governing their countries? What ability did they show in that? And I would suggest that a close examination of the way they ran their kingdoms or empires shows a singular lack of ability to really get to grips with the most important elements of what was going on in international relations. The courtier system was still very strong. In other words, if you wanted to be a success at court, one of the key elements was make sure you always flatter the king or emperor. That was guaranteed to get you ahead and keep you there. But once again, because of these close-knit, very often inter-familial relations that rule these courts, the people with real talent, the people who would have been able to steer a more reasonable course, were very rarely in the ascendancy. But times were changing, there's no doubt about it. One of the elements that we find at the beginning of the 20th century is the way socialism was spreading. It was spreading at a rate which alarmed many of the rulers. It was spreading because it reflected the large element of discontent at living conditions that was still very much the norm. Although, when I say that, I am not trying to negate the fact that a lot of social progress was in fact taking place. We know now from reliable economic histories, for example, that between 1890 and 1912, real wages rose in Europe by 48%. Now, that is no mean achievement. It also reflected something else. If we think about it, why were real wages able to rise at that rate? And one of the reasons was that, in general, economies of the key states were getting better. They weren't getting better at an even rate, thank you, but they were definitely getting better. Then, what is the usual result of improvement in living and social conditions? The obvious. People want more. No one is really satisfied if he thinks he can go that extra step. And therefore, it is a period when the demands for better living conditions and for democratic rights increase enormously. The call out there is, we the people are to be taken into consideration. We the people are not simply there for the whims of the rulers. Now, in reality, you had only one real democratic parliamentary system at work at the time in Europe, and that was in Britain. The nearest to that was the French system. But in reality, you had only one democratic parliamentary system actually working. But as we shall see, this is also a period when that system appears to be failing. It is a time, therefore, also of social turmoil. In 1905, Russia has its first revolution. It's not a large revolution, but it's an important revolution. It is a shock. The unthinkable in Russia had taken place. Europe was dominated by two alliances. The Triple Alliance between Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Italy, and the Triple Entente between Britain, France, and Russia. Now, that in itself is already an important indication. These countries feel the need for some type of group security. And if there is that need, or that perceived need, for group security, therefore, without any doubt, fear of military action by potential enemies is out there in the open. Let's look a little bit more at these two alliances. The Triple Alliance. Now, the Triple Alliance had in mind very much the traditional type of groupings that we had seen in Europe before. See, if we go back a bit in time, even pre-Congress of Vienna, what we're going to get is a type of haste between the smaller states, especially, to try and group together for self-defense. But we're not talking about small states here in the Triple Alliance. We're talking about Germany. We're talking about Austria-Hungary. And a rather nebulous member called Italy. Now, two things stand out there. Number one, without any shadow of doubt, militarily and economically, Italy is the weak point in that alliance. Again, something we have to keep in mind, Germany and Austria-Hungary, especially the Austrian part of that empire, share a lot of common characteristics. So, why Italy? Why did they want Italy in the Triple Alliance? Well, first of all, there were outstanding questions between Italy and Austria. Parts of Italy were still under Austrian control. The Italians didn't like it, and we shouldn't be surprised at that. So, pulling Italy in had one hopeful advantage, and that is to calm Italian pressure. Secondly, of course, Italy had a presence in the Mediterranean, which was also extremely important. Because one of the key questions of the time is not simply what's going on in continental Europe, but what's going on beyond continental Europe, including the European empires that had been built up. Now, Germany and Austria-Hungary had agreed to assist Italy if she were attacked by France. You see, again, let me stop a minute here and try to paint a picture of the kind of uneasy situation that was there. We have Italy worried about France, when in reality, if we stop to think about it, should Italy have been that worried about France? Wasn't France preoccupied by much larger questions, including its own fears of what Germany had in mind? So, the uncertainty is always there. But Italy wants to play it carefully. She does not want to get sucked into a war, not of her own choosing. And again, we can't blame this new country. After all, it's a country which had only existed for a few decades. It was still finding its feet, including economically. I shall speak a little about that later. Now, Italy was to assist Germany or Austria-Hungary if France declared war against either. So those two elements of the Triple Alliance counterbalance each other. They made sense. But if any of the three countries was at war with two or more powers, the other two were to provide military assistance. Now let me again pick up on something in that particular third point there. If any of the three were at war with two or more countries. You see, the great fear brought about by the instability that was Europe at the time was that chances were that if war broke out, this wasn't going to be a localized battle, a localized conflict between two states. Chances were that more than two would be involved. And chances were even greater that not only would there be more than two states, one on either side, involved, but that some states would gang up on other states. If any of the three launched a preventive war, the others would remain neutral. Now, that word preventive is really worth looking at. What was meant by preventive war? Well, in its real meaning, it means that you go to war in order to prevent an attack on you by another state. But I think the Triple Alliance meant a little something extra by the word preventive war. It meant an aggressive war. In other words, one of the states themselves becoming an aggressor, deciding to go to war. When you look closely, the effectiveness of the Triple Alliance was greater on paper than in reality. As I have already said, Italy was the weak link. But in doing so, I am not trying to paint a picture of two European superpowers who are trying to help and drag along an ailing state. Italy is still a developing state. Italy is unsure of what is happening. And there are other things that work in Italy as well. Public opinion and the leaders of the country are not exactly on the same wavelength. There isn't much love lost among many Italians towards the Austrians. Too much of Italy had been controlled by Austria in the past. They didn't much like them. At the same time, Italian politicians are trying to find, how shall I describe this, their own method of realpolitik. They want the survival of the country. They also want their country to grow in importance. And the thinking of the times was very clear. If a country was to grow economically and politically in the world in its importance, it needed colonies. That was the great target, the sought-after aim. And that is why the period we're talking about is characterized, among other things, by the scramble for colonies. And not just in Africa, as we very often are led to believe, but also in the Far East, in the Middle East. So, all these countries, in reality, have one eye beyond the shores of Europe as well. They're fledging the muscles. They're trying to find out how they could increase their wealth, how they could increase their political power, how they could become a power by using the magic formula of colonies. In 1914, Italy declared that since Germany had invaded France, it was involved in an aggressive war. There's no doubt about it. Italy was right. But there again, it wasn't consensus by the politicians, together with consensus by the people. It was rather the leaders, including the king of Italy, not being able to follow a policy of supporting Germany and Austria-Hungary because Parliament would not have it. And In Italy, one of the, I think, positives that we have at that time, it is one of the few states where the monarch cannot automatically overrule whatever parliament says. Now, other states tended to look on that situation as a weakness. I disagree. I think it was a strength which helped those countries who had that system develop better than others. Now let's look at Italy. To a certain extent, much of what I've said about Italy was understandable. Italy was economically and militarily weak. If you look, if you make any comparisons, if you go through economic histories of Europe at the time, this is a fact that hits you in the face. It was still a country which needed much development. Development was taking place. But in certain parts, especially in the south, the rate of development wasn't keeping pace. So you have a country which aspires to greatness, but does not have the instant wherewithal to actually go for it. Italy also wants colonies, and in 1912 you have a war with Turkey and with the Ottoman Empire. Italy comes off better off and manages to secure Libya as one of its colonies. To a certain extent, Italy is underlining that it has arrived. In truth, it still has a long way to go. But it cannot be disregarded. And this is important, because there was a tendency at the time in certain capitals to not count any Italian contribution. And as Germany and Austro-Hungary found later on to their cost, Italian contribution to the war, although derided by some at the time, was an important contribution. And after the initial setbacks, there was important military aid to the Allies. Now let's look at the Triple Entente. The Triple Entente, in contrast to the Triple Alliance, was meant primarily to provide a certain ease of mind. You see, the really questionable, if you like, nearly humorous part of it, that two of the countries which are grouped together in the Triple Entente are Britain and France, traditional enemies. Until 1905, British foreign policy is in fact directed by trying to ensure that there isn't an attack by France. Up to 1905, French military preparations include the possibility of an invasion of Britain. Things changed. Why did they change? They changed because of Germany, primarily. Because France had, on the other hand, traditional fear of Germany. It had, still fresh in French minds, the experience of the Franco-Prussian War, when the Germans reached Paris, and where Germany took over Alsace-Lorraine. So, the French were sure that sooner or later, Germany would again become an enemy. Now, what is the first thing they tried to do? Well, if Germany is going to be a possible enemy, it is important that you try and find out another possible enemy of Germany. and move closer to it. And France's choice from the beginning was Russia. Of course, geographically, as we shall see, Russia was extremely well placed to ensure that it would be an important ally in a war with Germany. If nothing else, an alliance between France and Russia, in which both sides would be prepared to come together in case of an invasion by Germany of either of those two countries, would mean that Germany would have to fight a war on two fronts, one in the east and one in the west. Now, Germany was prepared for that, as we shall see, or thought it was prepared. But the thinking, obviously, made sense. And as Britain became increasingly more certain that the probable enemy in the near future would be Germany rather than France, and that as France realized what was going on in that direction as well, it also became a sensible thing to do to reach an agreement, an arrangement with Britain. You see, Britain and France had two characteristics which, taken together, made a formidable alliance. Britain ruled the waves. Its navy was the strongest. No other power could take it on with ease of mind. In fact, traditional British policy, as far as the Royal Navy was concerned, was to ensure that they had a fleet which was strong enough to go into battle against the two largest European navies. That was British policy. It started to develop from Henry VIII, and it continued. France had a navy, but could not compare with that of the British. But France had an army. All right, French arms had been defeated in 1870-71, but they had recovered, and recovered well, with the result that France had a formidable army. So as we shall see in a moment, it made even greater sense if these two came together. One was a power on land, the other one was a power on sea. The two together, quite something to look at. There was one chink in this armor, though, with the Triple Entente, and that was that Britain never trusted Russia. If you look at Foreign Office documents, one of the things that strikes you very, very strongly is that there is an ingrained, deep distrust of the Russians. These are people who you never know which way they're going to blow, was one of the sentiments of the Foreign Office in London. But in reality, the French had it right. And this British distrust of Russia, though I'm not going to speak about that today, helped to bring about the Second World War. But that is another story. Now, if you look at that, you will immediately see what I'm trying to say. You've got Germany there, a huge Russian bear, and France. So a war on two fronts is going to stretch Germany like anything. Italy, of course, right in the middle of the Mediterranean. But now let's look at other elements. Let's go to the Balkans here. Now, the Balkans are without any doubt, at this time, the trouble spot of Europe. You have the Kingdom of Serbia, about which we shall speak later, which is a hotbed of intrigue. You have Bulgaria, not very far from that. And you have the Ottoman Empire, or, as it had been known for quite some time, the sick man of Europe, first propped up by Britain, now very much in the interest of the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians to come close to the Ottoman Empire, because of their own policies, at which we'll look later. And you've got Russia, who considers it herself as the protector of all the Slavs, and don't just look at Serbia as the place where the Slavs live, but much of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. Again, I shall come back to this. And, of course, Russia is worried whether the sick men of Europe might die in the hands of the Germans. However, in reality, if you look at all the factors involved, at the beginning of 1914, it seemed unlikely that war would break out that year between the two alliances. Because one of the things that the two alliances had come to accept was that they had to be careful if any member, any partner, was going to take the road of aggression. There had been confrontations. 1905, 1911, 1905 between even the French and the British. It was a time when it appeared that war might break out, but diplomacy solved the problems. And there was hope that even now in 1914, as problems appear to be mounting, that careful diplomacy could ensure that the fuse was not lit. How true was that? What were the chances of this happening? And I think before we can answer that question, we have to look in a bit more detail at some of the main protagonists. The Kaiser, Wilhelm II, had inherited his monarchy from Bismarck's grand plan. The problem was, as some historians have noted, that the system of government built by Bismarck was extremely difficult to sustain unless you had men of great intellect and political savoir. And unfortunately, Kaiser Wilhelm did not play in that league. He was very good about Prussian militarism. He was very good about playing roles and having large army parades and thinking in terms of war being a solution to state differences. But he could not really manage Bismarck's system of government. And this made the Kaiser a very unreliable partner for anyone to have. Not only that, but Kaiser Wilhelm was a great believer in the Germanic idea. Those great Germany. For a time, you find Wilhelm's Germany and Britain actually talking the same language. And this is a language which, of course, the rest of the continent wasn't very happy about. Because the language they were talking was that there were no white men in Europe beyond Germany's and Britain's borders. And you know what that means, or what they meant. They meant that the rest of Europe was an inferior category. No one could match the Germans or the British. And they were talking the same language, even at a time when there was great naval rivalry between them. As Germany sought to build its navy to match Britain's, and Britain became increasingly resentful of this German exercise, yet you find exchanges between the two navies taking place. Admirals going on visits being given the greatest honor that the fleet can give them, the opposite fleet. You see, they felt they had something in common. They were both Germanic peoples. And while Willem II still believed that Austria had a future as a great power, it would still be a future that would be tutored by Germany. Because there was no doubt about it, after the creation of Germany by Bismarck, Austria lost its predominance in the German world. Germany, without any doubt, was a leading European power. Try to apply all the criteria which make a really strong power, and Germany fulfilled it. No doubt about it. Its system of government was, however, a militarized autocracy. You see, it had a Reichstag, it had its parliament. But the system was flawed. For example, during the period we're talking about, the socialists are in power. You see, the largest number of socialists at the time to be found in Europe was in Germany. The socialists were in power. But the governing system that Germany had meant that the prime minister or chancellor and the ministers were chosen by the Kaiser. And the Kaiser couldn't give a toss for socialists. So he wasn't going to necessarily, and in fact he didn't, reflect in his choice of ministers the quality of the dominant element in parliament or their policy. The socialists were against militarism. They were against the possibility of war. But who does Kaiser Wilhelm have as his war minister? He's got Moltke. The person who believes that the strength of the army is the key to a nation. The person who believes that there is a destiny which calls for Germany to go to war. And parliamentarians in the Reichstag have absolutely no control over these ministers. Moltke, for long periods, doesn't even bother to communicate with them. They are beneath him. So, it is very much a situation where you have, in truth, real rule by the Kaiser and not by Parliament. As I said, Germany was the leading European power. Its industrial strength, reflected in manufacture and trade, was only surpassed by the United States of America. Now, if we go back 25 years, that was not the case. 25 years previous to that, the great battle for supremacy in trade and industry was between the United States and Britain, and Britain was losing it. Germany had overtaken Britain. The amount of trade it was carrying out, much of it with Britain, was welcome to the British. But at the same time, the British understood what was happening. They realized that the challenge that was coming from Germany was extremely difficult to even equal, let alone surpass. Germany had distinct colonial aspirations. It had joined in the competition for colonies and had its own colonies, but it was looking for other colonies beyond Africa. It wanted to stretch its power further. And this in itself was a challenge to the established colonial powers, the large colonial powers. I'm talking Britain and France. So, again, you have there the seeds of conflict. The naval race begins. When Britain builds its first dreadnought, this new, absolutely different type of battleship, the like of which has not been seen before by any navy, the Kaiser orders 6 dreadnoughts for Germany. They don't manage to get them, but the idea is there. And Britain builds others. Again, something which is not being realized, and it's not realized to the cost of European peoples particularly, is the way armaments were changing and how, in a very short period of time, their destructive power multiplied. German aristocracy simply detested the Russians. As far as the Germans were concerned, the Russians, being Slavs, were not really up to the level that Europeans should be. They disregarded the fact that, for example, the Russian capital was a center of culture, without any shadow of doubt. They disregarded the fact that French culture had such a strong influence in Russia. But to them, the Russians could not really be tolerated. Worse than that, the Russians, in their eyes, committed the greatest possible sin. They were protecting the Slavs outside Russia. And Germany couldn't have that. Neither could Austria-Hungary. With the result that Germany egged on Austria in its eternal fight with its Serbian and Slavic citizens to ensure that that it ruled with an iron hand. They don't deserve any better. There's no need to try and give them equality of status, for example. So, there again, Germany is committing an important mistake. It is not only egging Austria on in a way which would multiply its problems with the Slav people within its empire, but it is also giving clear hints to Austria later on. It's more than a clear hint, but at this stage it's still a clear hint that if Austria went to war with Serbia, it would support it. And Germany and Austria are increasingly of one mind. Serbia should be eliminated. Why have this troublesome entity right there next to us? So, this in itself is also in the mix as the mentality grows that there are differences which have to be solved, and dangerously so, because there are differences that need to be solved which are being seen from the point of view of pure nationalism. Nationalism that blinds. Now, again, we shouldn't be too surprised historically, because this is a time when many of these European countries are asserting themselves. They are asserting their nationalism. There was no World Cup to throw your nationalism into at the time. The banner you waved was a military one. The national flag represented much more than we automatically think of it representing today. But it was a dangerous nationalism. Now, if you look at this map of Africa, that gives you a clear idea of how the European powers had scrambled to get what they wanted in Africa. The green, of course, are the German colonies. The French, the red, the British. besides the Portuguese, obviously the Italians, the Spanish, so on. If you look at the world map and at the colonies, you can see in the Far East how the European powers are also so well represented. You know, I urge you students, particularly when you're dealing with international relations and history, always to keep handy a very good historical atlas. I remember the first time I walked into this university as a student to sit for my first lecture in the philosophy of history, and my professor said, they were his opening words, "History is about chaps, geography is about maps, but you need to put them together." And it's true. You need to look and see. Look at the influence. Look at the colors from there, and look at the influence of the Europeans in all these areas. And you also understand this great urge for colonies. Because the British had set such a good example. Great Britain had become great beyond its size because of the empire. Although by this stage, what nobody was yet realizing, but again, economic histories show this, was that the heyday of empire as an economic tool was starting to pass. Austro-Hungarian Empire, or the dual monarchy, as it was very often referred to. You had on the throne Emperor Franz Joseph, 83 years old. He'd been on the throne since 1848. Now, if you want an example of a situation where a man with nearly unlimited power is going to be manipulated by those around him, do you want a clearer one than that? Think about it. Again, he was a great lover of the military tradition, great lover of these beautiful feathered uniforms. But, the big but was, could he control high policy? And the answer, unfortunately, was no, he couldn't. Austria-Hungary had a population of 50 million. And this comprised, and I'll show you this before I go on, if you look at that map there, you've got the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And that contained what we today call Austria, Hungary, Slovakia, the Czech Republic, Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and parts of Poland and northeast Italy. So you have there, to a large extent, a whole conglomeration of nationalities put together. And not just a whole conglomeration of nationalities put together, but most of those nationalities are burning with a fierce nationalism. They don't want to take the Austrian yoke any longer. And this applies even to Hungary. Hungary is not particularly happy about being part of the dual monarchy at this stage. The Hungarians are also getting restless. But the real problem is here. These are where the problems are. Because the Slavs and the kingdom are extremely restive. Now, if we go back a moment, Parliament in the Austro-Hungarian Empire was noted very much for one characteristic, and that was its noisy squabbles between members of the different nationalities. In fact, this was the excuse used by Franz Ferdinand to shut down Parliament. He prorogued it indefinitely. And from then on, he ruled by decree. So, instead of actually listening to what was being said by these dissatisfied subjects, instead of asking the key question, surely the obvious question, how can I make them feel part of the empire? Those questions are never asked. The attitude taken is they have to be made to toe the line, or else. Now, of course, that kind of attitude is not going to help anyone. Austria-Hungary was still mostly a rural society. Now, I'm not saying that Vienna, for example, wasn't an extremely cultured city, for example, with great medical advances within it. I'm talking about Austro-Hungary as a whole. It was still very much a rural society. It did not, from the point of view of industry, compete with Germany, for example. Right? At the same time, the Austrians couldn't stand this Russian fixation with supporting the Serbs. And worse than that, they're supporting the Serbs in our empire. So they have every reason, if possible, to give Russia a bloody nose. In 1908, Austria-Hungary took over Bosnia-Herzegovina. This had been sort of handed over to them by the Ottoman Empire in order to administer. In 1908, they said it's part of the empire, full stop. Turkey was unwilling to go to much trouble over that. It had its own problems at the time. The Sultan had the problem with the Young Turks. So it was a very good time. But Russia resented this. How dare the Austrians treat a Slavic people in that way? When Russia prided itself on the fact that it had managed to free a considerable number of Slavs from the Ottoman Empire. So, Austrian foreign policy is by now firmly dictated by the relations which it has built, close relations, with Germany, Turkey, and Greece. And the main element of this policy, the central objective, is to thwart Serbia. As was to be expected, the army had immense influence in Austria. And again, that is a very dangerous sign. Soldiers are trained to know one language, and that's fight. The Russian Empire was an autocracy ruled by Tsar Nicholas II. Nicholas II was not overly intelligent, but at the same time, he was not a bad man. The problem with his position was that he was cut off completely by his court from the rest of the country. Wherever he went, people would be organized to wave and cheer. So he thought he was extremely popular. Everybody loved him, except they didn't. Because he was seen very often, especially by the political propaganda, which sought to foment unrest in Russia, as the person behind, the person really responsible for the suffering of the ordinary people. Again, modern histories, historians who have had access to Russian documents, which they didn't have before the fall of the Soviet Union, have now established that one of the great myths of the Bolsheviks was that Russia was in fact a really backward country. But I'll come to that in a moment. What Russia really feared was that Turkey would end up being dominated by Germany or by Germany through Austria. Because if it did, then, as I'm going to show in a second, it would have a real problem. Look at that map. 37% of Russian exports went through there. As long as the Ottoman Empire was so weak, so was control of the straits. But if Germany or Austria, or Germany through Austria, excuse me, were to be the controlling power not by taking over Turkey, but by taking over Turkish policy in support of Turkey, then Russia was going to have a major problem. One of the things that really angered the Tsar was the annexation of Bosnia-Herzegovina. And this festered. We cannot allow this. We cannot lose our pride as a nation by allowing fellow Slavs to be taken over. So, it made the mistake of, rather than encouraging Serbia to try and control Serbian subversion within the Austria-Hungarian Empire, it encouraged Serbia in its policy. And that spelled trouble. But the Russians, of course, with a population of 200 million and a standing army of 1.5 million, capable of being raised to 5 million on mobilization, felt pretty secure. If war came, they could, to a large extent, control events. But the empire itself was riven with problems. It had its own problems with nationalities, primarily because of its policy of Russification, especially in language. Now, there isn't anything more sensitive to nationalism as tempering or trying to absolutely eradicate a nation's language. And, of course, in Poland, Finland, and the Baltic states, and the Muslim Caucasus, for those who are unsure where it is, it's over there. It was there a moment ago. Oh. All right. There, the problems of Russification was absolutely great. And the empire closed its eyes to them. It did exactly as Austria-Hungary did with its own various nationalities. However, as I said, the Bolshevik myth that Russia was a backward industrial country has now been disproved. Because the Bolsheviks tried to give the image, when they took power, that it was they who kick-started Russian industrialization. And it was because of this that some of the atrocities that were committed on the working class had to be done. They had to be done because they needed to industrialize. But in reality, today we know that the Russian economy, in fact, was the fourth largest in the world at the time. Again, those who are studying international relations, don't disregard economic histories. They are extremely important. If you do that, you do so at your own peril. The national income of Russia had reached 80% of Germany's, 90% of Britain, and was more than 100% that of France. The problem with Russia, of course, was that although its national income had grown so far, it has a much larger population. So its direct effect was not seen in the same way as it would have been in one of the Western states. At the same time, political activity was rife. There was a great deal of anti-Tsar activity, together with industrial discontent, and this meant that, again, Russia was plagued by strikes. and some of them ended in bloodbaths. The Balkans, the troubled spot of Europe. It had become accepted at the time that if trouble broke out in the Balkans, it wasn't news. If there were assassinations reported, déjà vu. They go on all the time. This was the feeling. The Balkans were the problem. They were unstable by their very nature. They were unstable because of the people who lived in them and the way they looked on things. So an eye has to be kept all the time on the Balkans, because if we're not careful, they'll get us into trouble. Proved to be prophetic. Now, Europe's, southern Europe's Slav population lived in four states: the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Serbia, Montenegro, and Bulgaria. This did not mean, for example, that Bulgaria and Serbia would be friends. In 1813, they fight a war. Sorry, 1913. They fight a war. To give you an example, there is no real cohesion there between these Slav states. Serbia, which was mostly rural, however, had a strong agricultural economy and an expanding agricultural industry. It was not a poor country, and it was moving ahead economically. You know, when you're talking economics and economic history, obviously you have to look at the tools that are being used by the historian or the economist. No doubt about it. But I think if we put all things together, this picture of a Serbian economy which was on the move does in fact emerge. And I don't think there's much doubt about it. The Muslims, however, in Serbia had serious grievances. They were treated as second-class citizens at best. They were not happy to be part of Serbia. And this, a country which is continually protesting against the bad treatment of Slavs in other states. Not only that, but Serbia has a rather curious policy, because Serbia declares that wherever there are Serbs, that is Serbia. Now think a little about that and see how dangerous that is. Wherever there are clusters of Serbs, that is Serbia. In other words, it should be an extension of Serbia. So for Serbia, turning itself into Greater Serbia is policy. The only thing that we can say was that Austria's suspicion of Serbia was matched by Russian protectiveness. And here again, the Russians made a mistake on the same level as the Germans did with the Austrians. They encouraged Serbia. We will protect you. You have nothing to fear. And those are the kind of claims which get you into trouble. The Ottoman Empire, long-term, the sick man of Europe, first propped up by Britain, now by Germany. It contained 25 million people in 1914, of which 14 million were Turks. And obviously, like all the other empires, it contained separatist movements, nationalist movements. In other words, there was a certain degree of disarray held by weak central control. The way the Ottomans tried to solve this problem very often was by allowing local autonomy in certain parts of their empire. But it did not, in the long term, satisfy the cause of nationalism. When Abdul Hamid II was deposed following the Young Turk Revolution, he was replaced by Enver Pasha as the new leader of the country. He wanted to build a strong secular Turkey. He wanted a strong army. The Turkish army had performed very badly in the war it had in the Balkans, and therefore the Turks looked around to try and remedy the situation. How can we improve the army? And what do? They actually ask Germany for help. And they bring the German general, Liman von Sanders, in order to modernize the army. In reality, what they were doing and not realizing it was they were waving a red rag in front of the Russians. The greatest fear appeared to be becoming reality. The Germans are moving in into Turkey, into positions of trust, into positions of power. But in reality, Turkey was as concerned with Russian expansion as Russia was concerned with Turkish collapse. And this in itself fueled Turkish suspicions of what the Russians actually wanted. And in 1914, they signed a secret defensive alliance with Germany, but very prudently continued to have various talks with other powers. France, as I had said previously, had made great progress since its defeat in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71. Raymond Poincaré was executive president of France. He was the first, by the way, executive president of France. Previous to that, French presidents did not have executive powers, but he was the first one to have them. He was a Frenchman of the old school, in the sense that he absolutely distrusted the Germans. Now, you can't really blame France for that. All they had to do was look at the recent history. And now, as they looked at German expansionist policies, as they looked at German rearmament, the fears continued to grow. We can't, by any stretch of the imagination, feel secure with a Germany going through the process of getting stronger and stronger. They were worried about the demographic differences between the two countries. There were two Germans to every Frenchman. Worse than that, the birth rate was two Germans to one Frenchman. So there was no way they were going to catch up and make up the demographic deficit. So this increased the sense of vulnerability that France had. France, at the same time, was a thriving economy. It was a country of innovation. This is the time when France introduces its first electrified trains. The Lumiere brothers give us the cinema. Yet, with all its innovations, with all its intent on being prepared militarily, France does not really endorse military innovation. In 1933, France, however, introduced a three-year conscription period. Now, the introduction of a conscription period, which, as you might guess, is not exactly the most popular decisions a government can take, indicated, however, France's growing nervousness of being outmanned in a fight with Germany. The security it sought, of course, as we have already seen, was an alliance with Britain and Russia. In 1912, Britain and France concluded a military agreement, the Anglo-French Naval Convention. Now, although it was a naval convention, in fact, its terms were beyond the Navy. The idea was very simple. You have a large Navy, we have a large army. We take defense responsibilities on land, the French, the British take defense responsibilities at sea. Obviously, with the help of the French Navy, with the help of a British army. But the British army, remember, was a very small standing army. Again, this was traditional for Britain. Britain always tended to have a small standing army, and when war broke out on the continent, and it intended to intervene, it did one of two things, or the two things together. One, pay others to fight, or raise, and sometimes do both at the same time, raise the numbers of its army. But traditionally, it was a small standing army, even though it was a very well-trained army. One of the elements involved in the naval convention was, and this again points to two things, the importance and the vulnerability of empire. One of the points they raised was, we have to ensure the Suez Canal remains operative. It was the bloodline for Britain, it was essential for France. At the time, Britain was led by Prime Minister Asquith, a liberal. This is the last hurrah of the liberals in Britain. And again, it is in line with what is happening in Europe. Liberalism is dying. Socialism is coming to the fore. It had the largest empire the world had ever seen, but, and this is the but which was not realized at the time, but again, economic histories have now established this quite clearly. By 1890, the empire was no longer a paying concern. It had started to cost Britain more than it got out of it. It wasn't much at the time, but the trend was there, and it continues. It is also a country of great social inequalities. Let me give you two statistics. 5% of the population in 1910 earned £800 million between them. You know what £1 million in 1910 meant? A little more than €5. In that year, the other 95% of the population earned £800 million. Now work that out for inequality. Yet, times were also changing. And they were changing because of the ferment, industrial and social, that was taking place in England. In 1911, for example, Britain lost 10 million working days due to industrial action. And interestingly enough, only a small fraction of those were caused by union action. All the others were unilateral action. These were the times when repeatedly the answer to a strike is send in the troops. They either get back to their place of work, if they cause trouble, shoot them. There's nothing to bring you to your senses than a bullet. You have also the suffragette movement. I know this is a statistic which will probably shock more of the calmer section of the audience, but in the first 7 months of 1914, the suffragettes set fire to 107 buildings. The point I'm trying to prove, it wasn't a small problem. They wanted the vote, and by hack or by hell, they were going to get it, no matter what. The Asquith administration has been considered by many as one of the weakest governments in Britain. In reality, that can be a rather unfair comment, because very few governments face so many problems at the same time as the Asquith government did. And it did try to alleviate social concerns. But the pace was slow. The pace was not considered enough. Let's look at this map. Look at all the pink stuff. That's the British Empire. You'll notice if you put them all together, all the areas together, there'll be a quarter of the globe, roughly. Slightly larger than Malta. And when you look at that, and when you remember that that was seen, and for a time, correctly seen, as the basis of British power, no wonder they wanted colonies. But the Asquith government was facing large problems. And the message going across to the rest of Europe was that this is an island in decline, an island totally insecure. The worst of it came with the attempt to solve the so-called Irish problem. What you get is Protestant rebellion in Ulster. The army is ordered in, and army officers, unheard of, demure to take action. They won't take action against the rebels. In Parliament, again, unheard of, the opposition not only attacks the government for its policy in Ulster against the Protestant rebels, but actually denounces the government as taking illegal action. So, put yourself in other European capitals, looking at what is happening in Britain. Transfer your mind to Germany and ask yourself whether this was not a legitimate question. If war breaks out, isn't Britain going to be thankful not to be part of it? And much of the conclusion is that it would be. At the same time, British public opinion is becoming increasingly anti-German, driven by a press campaign of immense volatility. It is a time when the British press is at its largest ever. It has never been read by so many people before. Its influence has never been as great. And the message continually is the Germans are becoming too big for the boots. The Germans have to be put in place. We can't stand by and let them trample over us. This was the message of the press. On the other side, as I have already said, Germany thought Britain was becoming too weak to really interfere, but worse than that, Germany forgot completely, or disregarded completely, the traditional British policy as far as Europe was concerned was the maintenance of the balance of power. In other words, making sure that no one single European country would be in a position to dominate Europe. And to British eyes, that prospect now was represented by Germany. Of course, they knew nothing of the European Union. On the other side of the Atlantic, the United States was quiet in its splendid isolation. It does not want to have anything to do with these Europeans. They're always bickering. They're always fighting. Get involved and you're in trouble. keep them at arm's length, or better still, at Atlantic Ocean length. Don't have anything to do with them. And with a population of 100 million and growing, the United States is now definitely the wealthiest country in the world. You see, although trade was important to the United States, even trade with Europe, of course, the reality was that in this phase of its development, the United States could still grow its economy through internal trade and through internal economic activities, let alone by means of trade. It was by far the most industrialized. It was the country which welcomed industrialization with open arms. President Woodrow Wilson was a pacifist by nature, in the sense that he felt that war was not the answer to international problems. He was also very influenced by the isolationist movement in the United States, which was very strong, and also by the pacifist movement, again, a very strong movement. And there did not seem to be any convincing arguments to try and interfere in European affairs. Britain was making early efforts to try and get the Americans to look at the problems of Europe from a different point of view. It wasn't succeeding. The USA had ensured it had no overseas alliances, so it felt free to move in any way it wanted to, and it moved in the direction of neutrality. There was, however, pressure as a means of ensuring that it was prepared if something occurred which was not envisaged, of trying to enlarge its army. Thus, in the summer of 1914, Austria-Hungary was desperate to shore its crumbling power in the Balkans. It believed that the destruction of Serbia was essential to the continuation of the empire. Germany made its irresponsible promises to Austria that it would support it come what may. It egged her on. You do it, we'll support you. On the other hand, Russia was bound to Serbia. Now, do not be surprised at this. It is not something that has died. Look at the way even Russia today wants to be part, to have influence over Slavic regions in Europe. Look how careful, for example, was the Serbian declaration of a short time ago that they wanted to be members of the European Union, but this did not mean that they were turning their back on Russia. So these were deeply rooted feelings. On the other hand, anti-German sentiment was rife, and France was at the stage thinking, what happens if Serbia and Austria go to war? We can stay out, but we might even profit from the fallout. Typically, realpolitik. So, I've got this quotation from Jolyn Martel from the book The Origins of the First World War, because I think it does capture very much what was going on. What is more important than the immediate responsibility for the actual outbreak of war is the state of mind that was shared by all belligerents. A state of mind that envisaged the probable imminence of war and its absolute necessity in certain circumstances. In other words, the mentality of expecting war, that it is probable. It's not a question of might happen. We've moved to a stage that it will happen. The question is when and how necessary would it be to go to war. That's the mentality that was reigning in Europe. The mindset was there. All that was required was an excuse. On 28 June 1914, Gavrilo Princip, a member of the Serbian Black Hand terrorist organization, shot and killed Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria-Hungary and his wife Sophie in Sarajevo. The short fuse to the powder keg that was Europe had been lit. And if you want to know where that happened, that's the bridge they had just crossed, and that's the plaque that commemorates the event if you go there today. What many had feared was about to take place. But even those who were expecting that Serbia might be involved somehow, and when I say that, I don't want to be misunderstood, I am not accusing Serbia of being behind the assassination, but it happened in Serbia. It happened by a Serb. So what I'm saying is this. Although Serbs were expected to be involved in any problem that arose, no one thought, by any stretch of the imagination, that events would move as swiftly as they did. 23rd July, Austria-Hungary sends an ultimatum to Serbia in expectation that it would be refused. For that ultimatum, actually expected Serbia to say, we were responsible for the assassination. In fact, Serbia made a very valid attempt to calm the Austria-Hungarian Empire. They said, we've arrested those involved. We're going to ensure that, if need be, any anti-Austrian terrorists will be handed over to Austria. We are going to make sure that the press in Serbia is controlled and does not incite anti-Austrian violence. But we're not going to accept that Serbia was responsible, because it wasn't. And the Austrians knew this. And the Austrians knew that that would make it unacceptable to Serbia. Sir Edward Grey, the British Foreign Secretary, was moved to comment that he had never before seen one state address to another independent state a document of so formidable a character. 28 July, Austria-Hungary declares war on Serbia. 31st July, Russia mobilizes. Look at the dates. 1st August, 2 days later, Germany and France mobilize. 3rd August, Germany declares war on France. 4th August, Germany invades Belgium and Luxembourg. Britain declares war on Germany. 18th August, USA declares itself neutral. That's fast. By no stretch of the imagination. And why has Britain suddenly intervened? Because Britain resurrects an 1839 guarantee to Belgium that it would protect its neutrality. The Germans were nonplussed. They're going to war, they said, that's what Moltke said, because of a scrap of paper, which everybody had forgotten about. But of course, Britain wasn't going to war over that scrap of paper. It was worried about what the outcome would be. 29 September 1914, Japan declares war on Germany. 29 October 1914, Turkey declares war on the Allies. 25 May 1915, Italy declares war on Austria-Hungary. 14 October 1915, Bulgaria declares war on Serbia. February 1917, revolution breaks out in Russia. The Tsar abdicates. 6th April 1917, USA declares war on Germany. Why? For three main reasons. Number one, Germany had started a policy of unrestricted submarine warfare. Now, unrestricted submarine warfare meant that the targets were not merely naval ships, but any ships approaching the coastline of an enemy country. They had stopped that policy for a time because of the outcry that had arisen, including America. But later on, as the war starts to turn against them, they resort to it. That was one reason. The second reason was the Zimmerman telegram. This was a telegram which was sent from Berlin to Mexico, to the government of Mexico, in which the Germans were encouraging Mexico to declare war on the United States. The cable was picked up by the British intelligence and obviously made available to the Americans in no time whatsoever. So that was the second thing. And the third, of course, was the sinking of the Lusitania, the liner with so many souls on board. And that was the last straw. American opinion, which had been neutral, was rapidly turning against Germany. So much so that the declaration of war passes through Congress and Senate in 4 days. All Winston needs to do is present it. Now go back a minute. Now this, as you heard Dr. Samut say in the introduction, was going to be the war that would be over by Christmas. Don't kid yourselves, it was a popular war in the countries that had entered it. Armies marched off to war, accompanied by bands and young ladies throwing flowers at the soldiers. Everybody was going to be the hero. Everybody would be back to tell the story in 4 months' time. We'll be back by Christmas. They forgot to mention which Christmas. After 4 years and millions of deaths, the Central Powers were exhausted militarily and economically. One of the lessons of this modern war, much more than any other war, was that its sheer destructiveness and the large amount of economic effort required to sustain it meant that unless you had enough economic depth, sooner or later you finished. And that's what happened to Germany. 30th September, Bulgaria signs an armistice. 30th October, the Ottoman Empire does the same. 3rd November, Austria and Hungary follow suit. 9th November, the German Republic declared. The Kaiser, like all good dictators, fled. He went to the Netherlands. On 11th November 1918, Germany signs the armistice. War was over. The guns were silent. Millions were still suffering the consequences, either because of the wounds they received or because of the destruction of their property. Europe had never experienced such a war before. It was unthinkable 4 years earlier that what took place had actually happened, but it had. And of course, the thoughts now went to what kind of a Europe are we going to have after this war? And this was a very important question. The problem was that the three major allies could not agree on what they wanted. France had one simple solution: make sure that Germany is demilitarized and weakened permanently. That way, Germany will never again be a threat to France. Britain agreed about demilitarization of Germany, but this weakening of the economy didn't please it. It would hit British trade. And Britain was not exactly solvent. The war had forced it to pay a large price economically. I shall come to that later. The United States, represented by thinking of President Woodrow Wilson, who had entered the war with a certain degree of moral stature. If we're going to fight, if we are forced to fight, let's fight for moral reasons. And he comes out with his 14 points. Right? And now we've got the peace, we have to ensure that those moral reasons are put into practice. If they're not put into practice, then we've fought the war for nothing. So let's look at some of the consequences, shall we? First of all, the German Empire was no more. Germany lost territory to Denmark, Belgium, and Czechoslovakia. It lost Alsace-Lorraine to France. It saw the temporary occupation of the Rhineland. Large swath of territory was lost to Poland, including Danzig. East Prussia was separated from the rest of Germany. It lost all of its overseas colonies. It was forced to accept reparation payments of 132 billion marks. It was forced to permanently reduce its army to 100,000 and destroy her tanks, air force, and U-boat fleet. Give you some example. Poland now is created again. The Danzig corridor separates West Germany from East Prussia. And that is something which the Germans absolutely cannot accept. Worse than that, some of the German populations, for example, the creation of Czechoslovakia, 4 million Germans find themselves citizens of Czechoslovakia. Again, if the lessons had been learned of what had happened in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, for example, in the Ottoman Empire, that should have been unthinkable. But primarily, Germany had to be punished. Look at the African colonies. That was German before, lost. That was German before. That was German before. That was German before. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was no more. The republics of Austria and of Hungary were set up. Hungary lost 2/3 of its territory. No joke. Which meant that a large number of Magyars, Hungarians, found themselves citizens of other states. It lost Bohemia, Moravia, Silesia, Klesin, Slovakia, Carpathian, Ruthenia, which became Czechoslovakia. The Tyrol and Trieste went to Italy, and Italy wasn't really satisfied. Is that all we get out of the war? Bosnia-Herzegovina, Croatia, Dalmatia, Slovenia, Vojvodina, and Serbia become the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes. The later, the Kingdom of Yugoslavia. There it is. Over here. Serbia, and so on. Now, that became the Kingdom of Yugoslavia, but again, one of the peripheral results of the Great War, that was, to a large extent, artificial. It went against one of the cardinal principles which the leaders of the Allies had proclaimed at the beginning of the war, the self-determination of nations. But then when they came to the peace treaty, they said, but these are too small. They can't exist as independent entities. So we'll patch them together, create the Kingdom of Yugoslavia, and prepare a bad blood for the 1990s. There, again, you can see the areas much more clear. The Russian losses. The Baltic states of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia were lost, although they were regained by the Soviet Union in 1940. And Finland became an independent state. Armenia, Georgia, Azerbaijan were established as independent states, but in 1922 they joined the Soviet Union. The end of the Ottoman Empire. Ottoman Empire was no more. Syria and Lebanon became French mandates. Mesopotamia, Palestine, and Transjordan became British mandates. Ottoman territory in the Arab Peninsula became modern times Saudi Arabia and Yemen. And this is the new Europe that emerged after the First World War. You can see the creation of Czechoslovakia there, Yugoslavia there. Look at how Austria has shrunk. Look at how Hungary has shrunk. Poland, after a very long time, is again independent. Italy gets that area. France gets Alsace-Lorraine and feels a little bit safer, but doesn't really learn the lesson of the war, as we shall see in a moment. The victors, the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom had suffered economically, so much so, and very often we don't actually realize this, that in its effort to fund the war, the United Kingdom became one of the world's largest debtors. Last week, we had the astonishing news that the British government had decided to pay 281 million of its first World War I debt. It is still servicing its war debt, First World War debt. Up to last year, it was costing it 400,000 a year. Free German coal, which started to reach Britain, seemed to be a plus. But in effect, it had a very bad effect on local production. So much so that coal mining started to decline in Britain, with the result that in 1926 you have the very destructive general strike. The empire started to come under pressure with independence claims and unrest growing. In India, you have unrest. In Egypt, you have unrest. In Ireland, you have the Easter Rising. In Malta, you have Sette Junior. These are all symptoms of peoples who are seeing that changes can take place, that political change is possible. You only have to press for it. The creation of the Irish Free State was symptomatic of the changed international climate, something which would have been unacceptable to Britain 20 years previously. France made territorial gains, including the retaking of Alsace-Lorraine. It got its way in forcing Germany to pay punitive reparations for the war. It gained new colonies, but the experience of repatriated colonial troops helped to stir trouble within the empire. France, during this war, used a large number of colonial troops. When they went back, they suddenly became unimportant citizens again. We find many of the leaders of the anti-French struggle in the French colonies having served in the First World War. Despite its continued suspicion of Germany, it failed to learn the defensive lesson of war, its vulnerability to German invasion through Belgium. Let's go back a second. There we have it. When it prepares just in case it's going to be attacked, it defends there and forgets about here. And the Germans do exactly the same in 1939 as they did in 1914. Sorry, but you were asleep. The USA had entered the war. Wilson had brought out his moral justification. He spoke in terms of open international agreements, no more secret agreements between states, their trouble, free trade, self-determination of nations, and general democracy. Britain and France at the time said, oh, yes, it's such a wonderful idea. But when it came to actually applying them, they didn't think they were so wonderful, after all. His aims were not shared by France and Britain. What do you get? Although one of the dreams of Woodrow Wilson was to create a League of Nations, and it does take place, the United States is so disenchanted with what happens at Versailles that it won't even join the League of Nations, and it scuttles back to its policy of isolation. Definite weaknesses in the Treaty of Versailles. Today, historians are arguing on whether the long-held view that the Treaty of Versailles ensured the outbreak of World War II, whether that is correct. And various theories are emerging, and some of them quite plausible. But it doesn't mean that Versailles did not have important weaknesses. For example, it was supposed, the war was supposed, and Versailles following the war, was supposed to ensure, to promote, to restore European stability and maintain everlasting peace. According to that dictionary, everlasting peace meant 20 years. The Allies' inability to cooperate towards a lasting agreement was exposed. There's no longer a common policy because the war is over. And this helped to further fuel German nationalism. The Germans saw themselves as having been forced into an agreement because they couldn't help it, which was demeaning, insulting, and which would prevent them from becoming economically strong again. And worse than that, the Allies, once they had forced Germany to sign the treaty, had no way of enforcing it without actually wanting to go to war again, which they didn't want to do. So I think Hobsbawm's theory there is worth thinking about. The Versailles settlement could not possibly be the basis of a stable peace. It was doomed from the start, and another war was practically certain. Perhaps not practically certain, but at least likely. Now, the League of Nations has, of course, been very, very highly criticized, ineffective, to a dead letter from its start. It wasn't a dead letter from its start. It has its importance. The League of Nations was the first real attempt in the world of international relations to create some kind of policing order, which did not mean policing by one state because it was stronger than any other. So it did have its merit. It was weak, yes, but it did lead the way to the United Nations of today, which is still has weaknesses. It still bows its head to the great powers, or those who were great powers, some of them, because of the veto in the Security Council. But it does provide a forum for diplomacy, for talking rather than fighting. As Churchill said, Georgia is better than war. So it's better to talk, even if you might feel it's not getting you very far, rather than to take up arms. It was the forerunner, of course, of the United Nations, as I said, and the attempt in 1945 to build a new world. Again, not very successful. Post-1945, we get the oncoming Cold War. But that is another story, and I'm not going there. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Pirotta. And we hope that you will be able to... You gave us a great overview of all the events that led to the First World War as we are marking the 100th anniversary. And we would like to invite you back, hopefully, maybe sometime next year, to mark the 70th anniversary of the end
Me
of
and
the
my
Second
big
World
mouth.
War to give us that kind of this kind of overview. Are there any questions, possibly? We have about 5 minutes, and then we will have to leave the room. So if there is a quick question,
make your questions
perhaps
very long, so that I won't have time to answer them.
Why did Bulgaria declare war on
Serbia?
Serbia, yeah.
Because it hoped that at the end of the war, Serbia would be defeated together with the other allies, and it would take over Serbia.
Okay, so I think we can end the session here. It was a long session, which we really enjoyed. Most of the students here are first-year international students, international relations students, and I think it was a wonderful introduction for them. Thank you, Professor Pirro.
Thank you for attending.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the International Relations Department entitled The World Unravels, Reflections on the First World War. This talk was delivered by Professor Joseph Pirotta.